The universe is infinite, we think, but can we be sure? Within the limits of what we know now, we're pretty sure, but the limits of our knowledge will come front and center today. This is a chance for us to not only think about what we know, but how we can be sure we know it. Today's guest wrote a book called The Island of Knowledge, The Limits of Science and the Search for Meaning. It is the creation of Marcello Gleiser, who is the Appleton Professor of Natural Philosophy and Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Dartmouth College. He is the author of three other books, including A Tear at the Edge of Creation, for which he joined us back in April of 2010. Marcello Gleiser, thanks so much for coming back to the Jefferson Exchange.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
So philosophy and physics, this is not a standard combination of disciplines. What got you into both of these, or both of these simultaneously, I guess?
Well, you're right. I mean, in the past, they were the same thing, right? They were called natural philosophy. And so the people doing the science were actually considered philosophers in many ways. But then there was a big split around the 18th century or so, where science became a much more pragmatic and data-oriented thing, and philosophy, you know, stayed with the big question, so to speak. And the point, though, is that if you do the kind of science that I do, which is interested in questions of origins, you know, origin of the universe, origin of matter, origin of life, so big questions, it's very difficult to not think philosophically about what's going on. Now, that does not make me the rule. It makes me a bit of the exception among scientists. You know, most scientists do not take philosophy that seriously, but I can't avoid doing it. I think that to think seriously about what space, time, matter, energy, existence means, you cannot just think about it scientifically. You have to also think about it philosophically.
So we're thinking essentially about what we think and how we know what we know?
Exactly, because, you know, science is our attempt to make sense of reality, right? I mean, it's the way we look at the world and we see all this diversity out there, and we're trying to understand what's going on. We quickly realize that there are events which are regular, like the seasons or the phases of the moon, and then we see events which are not regular, like a volcanic eruption or an earthquake. And so what science is trying to do is trying to find patterns in this diversity of things that go on around us. And in doing so, we do what we can with our senses, the stuff we can see things, we can hear things, but that kind of perception of reality is very limited, right? We can only see a very small fraction of what's truly going on around us. So I always like to say that, you know, we evolved in a planet which is close to a star, which emits a lot of radiation around the yellow, and that's why we can see things in the visible. But then we can't see the infrared radiation, we can't see ultraviolet, X-rays, etc., which doesn't make it less real, just make it not real to us directly through our senses. So what do? We amplify our vision of reality using instruments. I call them reality amplifiers, like telescopes and microscopes and detectors of all kinds. And those machines allow us to see and to probe worlds which are invisible to our senses. And we keep doing this. And you can actually tell the whole history of science just by talking about the history of how certain tools really changed the way we think about the world. You know, the telescope and the microscope, of course, being the most famous examples. And because of that, because so much of what we see is dependent on how we see it through our tools and the way even our brain works, which is sort of a parallel conversation we can have, then we also understand that we can only see so far, and that our perception of reality is necessarily limited by the way we interact with it. There was this French philosopher from the late 17th century called Bernard de Fontenelle, who said something really wonderful. He said that all philosophy is due to two things only, curiosity and short-sightedness, you know, because it's wonderful, right? Because we always want to know more, right? We're curious about the world. We want to understand everything that we can. But on the other hand, we are myopic. You know, we can only see so far. And because of this tension, because between what we want to know and what we can't know, we try to invent tools, we are use our creativity. So being myopic is not necessarily a bad thing. It's what majorly is trying to extend our creativity into these realms which escape us, you know. So it's all connected in a sense. So not seeing everything is not a bad thing necessarily. It's a good thing because it makes us be it makes us creative.
Marcello Gleiser, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He is a professor of philosophy and professor of physics and astronomy at Dartmouth College, the author of a book, The Island of Knowledge, The Limits of Science and the Search for Meaning. And as you can tell, we're going to get in fairly deep in this hour. Lots of stuff to talk about here, and you can join our discussion on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, around the listening area in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email address jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Marcello Gleiser and you in a minute 30. This is the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is Marcello Gleiser. He is a philosopher, a physicist, an astronomer, working as a professor at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. And he's written a book called The Island of Knowledge, The Limits of Science and the Search for Meaning. If you'd like to join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we essentially think about thinking and figure out what we know about what we know, join us at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, email address jx@jeffnet.org. So the island, Marcello, represents what we know surrounded by mystery, right?
Right. So I'll explain this metaphor of the island of knowledge because I think it illustrates quite well the way we make sense of things. So let's imagine that everything that we know of the world fits in an island. And this knowledge is not necessarily only scientific, you know, it can be artistic, it can be philosophy, it can be everything that we put together to make sense of what's going on, so to speak. So the island grows because we know more about things. Sometimes it goes back and shrinks because sometimes ideas that we thought were right are actually wrong and we have to self-correct. But as a rule, you know, as time goes by, the island of knowledge is growing. Now, growing into what? Well, you know, as any good island, it's surrounded by an ocean, and I call this the ocean of the unknown. So as the island grows, you know, you'd say, well, there are two positions here. You know, one is to say, well, the island is going to keep growing, and eventually it's going to cover the whole ocean of the unknown, and we're going to reach this complete knowledge of everything there is to know, and there'll be the end of it. And a lot of people have written books titled like The End of Science or The End of Physics or something like that. And then there's the other position, which is the one that I defend, which is that this is quite naive, this idea that we can actually have complete knowledge of things. That what does happen is that as the island grows, so do the shores of our ignorance. That is, the boundary between what we know and what we don't know is also growing, right? And we become more equipped to ask questions that before we couldn't even dream about. Great example being, say, the microscope. So before we knew about the microscope, before von Leeuwenhoek invented the microscope in the late 1600s, we had no clue that life could be so tiny, right? But then there you have the microscope and you look at a drop of water and you see all these creatures, you know, in this drop of water that you did not even know existed. So a new tool essentially is giving you this whole new world to probe and new questions to ask. So as the island of knowledge grows, our ignorance is also growing because you're beginning to understand the extent of what you still do not know. So to me, knowledge is an endless pursuit because it's by its very nature, you know, it kind of gives you opportunities to ask new questions as you advance knowledge. And it's a wonderful thing.
But when you say ignorance, I mean, is that a certain level of smugness because we think we've learned a great deal and think we're more better equipped to find out more?
Well, yes. I mean, what I mean by ignorance is not like in the bad way. It just means the extent of what we still do not know, right? But you're absolutely right. I think that in science, and sometimes even when scientists make public pronouncements, we detect a little bit of arrogance, right? In the sense that, yes, we know so much, we are the best, etc., and we can conquer it all. There is this sort of idea that science is this knight in shining armor that is going to answer everything. And you know, people have to understand that I am a scientist and I'm a great defender of science. You know, there couldn't be a more enthusiastic person, you know, when it comes to talk about how science transforms the way we live and et cetera. However, I think we also have to be honest about how science actually does work and what it can do and what it cannot do. So my book is a bit of a countercurrent in the sense that I am criticizing this sort of scientism position that says to people that give us enough time and we are going to crack everything. You know, and I don't think life is that simple.
Marcello Gleiser, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Island of Knowledge. Let's take a call here. Here's Skeeter in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hiya. About 40 years ago, Buckminster Fuller visited the University of Oregon. I attended the lecture. He was talking about our spaceship Earth. And in conjunction with his lecture, he showed a film called The Power of Ten, where I think it's just Power of Ten. I'm not sure if you've ever seen it. But
yes.
In the course of that, they showed graphically, and I think a little bit with animation, the extent of how far out into space and how deep into inner space on the microscopic and on the macroscopic level people had seen at that point in terms of by the mid-1970s. The thing that astounded me is that when you got to the farthest reaches of both way out there and way in there, down to the atomic level, there were extreme similarities visually. And it made me think, you're familiar with what a Möbius strip is, like when you get a piece of paper and you twist it once and then you attach it. I'm wondering, what is your opinion of, do you think that at some point in our universe that we can sense here, that the macro and the micro are somehow connected eventually?
Interesting concept. Thanks for that, Skeeter. Appreciate it.
Yeah, that's a very nice question. And so the way we look at that today, and it's interesting, the Powers of Ten movie is the kind of movie that you have to keep remaking, right? Because we keep advancing both into the outer universe, right? Farther and farther away from us, and also into the inner universe, you know, the world of subatomic particles that we learn more and more all the time. But to answer your question, the deep connection between the inner, you know, this micro and the macro world comes when you put into this equation the fact that the universe is a dynamic entity that actually had a beginning in the past. So if you look at what we know of the universe right now, okay, we know that the universe, and when I say the universe, we have to be very careful about what I mean. The universe that we can measure is a bubble, essentially, of information, okay, that is how far light could have traveled since the beginning of time, okay? And the beginning of time is about, just in round numbers, 14 billion years ago. So since light is really fast, but not infinitely fast, in 14 billion years, it could travel a certain distance. And that is essentially the amount of information we can get of the universe, okay? Now, because the universe has a history, if you play this movie backwards, right, the universe, we know now that the universe is expanding, meaning the galaxies are moving farther and farther away from one another. But if you play this movie backwards, then you see the galaxies getting closer and closer to one another and closer and closer until, as you go really far back in time, to say a fraction of a second, after the beginning of time, or the Big Bang, if you want, there were no galaxies, there were no stars, there were no atoms, there were just a bunch of free particles moving about, which basically means something very deep and very important, which is that if you want to make sense of the infancy of the universe, you know, the cosmic babyhood, so to speak, you really have to use your knowledge of particle physics, you know, the world of this subatomic physics, in order to make sense of what's going on. And so there's a deep connection between that primal history of the universe and the history that we have today. So a lot that has happened in the universe depends on this initial states where the knowledge from particle physics, from the very small, dictates what's going to happen later, billions of years later, if you want, with the very large. So that's the real connection between the two.
A real crossing of realms, starting with the microscopic and going on to the infinite. Marcello Gleiser is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Island of Knowledge, The Limits of Science and the Search for Meaning. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we explore this. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. So in the Big Bang, the expansion of the universe you just mentioned, and if you play the movie forward now, so you say not to think of it as a bomb exploding. So,
right.
So how should we think of it?
Yes, so that is the most common confusion that people have. You know, when you talk about the Big Bang, people immediately imagine a bomb, you know, going off at some point in space, and that the galaxies are kind of like the shrapnel, you know, of the explosion moving off. Well, that image assumes something very fundamental. It says that that space is static, you know, that the bomb goes off and the galaxies are moving in the background of a static space, right? That space is essentially the stage where things happen, right? And that is the vision, say, that Newton had and that physics had, until Einstein came into the game and changed this whole story by saying that space is not static, that space is actually dynamic. It can stretch around, and just like a rubber sheet, so to speak, and that the expansion of the universe that we see is really not so much the galaxies moving away from one another like if they were shrapnel from an explosion, but it's really galaxies being carried away by the stretchy space. So it's space itself that is kind of like rubbery, and it's moving it's basically growing, so to speak, and carrying the galaxies with it, just like quarks get carried if you put them on a river, right? They get carried by the current. So galaxies are being carried by this current, by this space that is growing like a rubber sheet being stretched out. And that's really the image that is correct when we think about the expansion of the universe. So the expansion of the universe really is a stretchiness of time, of space, so to speak.
Let us take another call. Here's Grumpy John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Professor Marcello Gleiser.
Well, thanks very much. About the expanding universe, I think it just proves that even gravity gets tired.
Explain, please.
on a more serious note, you're positing a limit, like the speed of light, exists. That's an interesting concept, but I don't really think it does. I think there is good evidence for the fact of instantaneous transmission of knowledge and consciousness. And science, I don't think, is capable of accepting stuff they can't explain, so they just ignore it, just like they can't really explain what happens with music. They can't predict next month's hit song, for instance. So instantaneous transmission of knowledge voids the limitations of the speed of light. I would like you to discuss it a little bit, please. Thank you.
Thank you for that,
sure.
Grumpy John. Wow.
Well, I have to tell you that I spent quite a lot of time talking about that in the book, exactly this notion. So we have to understand something very important here, which is that when we talk about the speed of light as being a limiting speed, what we mean by that is a limiting speed that information can travel in space. And by information, we mean either light itself, you know, little photons, little bullets of light traveling, or particles. Okay, and it turns out that what that means is that anything that has mass, like an electron has a mass or a person has a mass, can never really reach the speed of light. Only things which are massless, that have no mass, can travel at the speed of light. For example, light itself. Now, and so that is a fundamental limit of nature, and we see that and we measure that, and our GPS works because of that. However, there is a, I don't know if this is what you have in mind, but there is a very interesting and mysterious effect in quantum physics, which is called entanglement. And that is what Einstein used to call the spooky action at a distance. And the reason why he called that, and that really bothered him tremendously, the reason why he called that, because it really looks like you have two systems that are separated in space. Okay, and yet if you change one of them, the other responds instantaneously, or if not instantaneously, certainly faster than the speed of light. So it looks like these two systems are communicating, exchanging information, if you will, faster than the speed of light, which may be what the caller was referring to. Now, and this is a real effect. It's happening all the time, and in fact, it's being used in Europe right now to transmit banking information with high security. It's called quantum cryptography, and it's going to be the secret behind a new kind of computer. It's called quantum computers. So, quantum entanglement is not science fiction. It's something that is really there. Now, it's important to understand that nothing is really being transmitted in space from one point to another when this is happening. And that's what's really weird about this whole thing, is that, so let me see if I can create an image here. Imagine that you have a top spinning clockwise and another one spinning anti-clockwise, mm-hmm. Okay? So you have these two little tops, and you prepare them together. So let's call this top a quantum state, okay? These two tops together are a quantum state. In reality, you're talking about electrons, you're talking about photons, but the tops will work. So now what you do is you separate them from one another, okay? So they're moving away from one another at a certain speed. And what quantum entanglement tells you is that even though they're separated by a certain distance, they're still a unit, okay? Which seems to be independent of how far they are. So if they are 20 yards away, and if you do something to one of them, the other will respond instantaneously. If they are a galaxy distance apart, like 100,000 light years apart, the same would happen. Of course, we haven't tested it yet, but we have tested entanglement at very large distance of hundreds of miles, and it seems to work. As long as the system is very well isolated from the environment, okay? So entanglement is a very, very fragile state. So if you have any sort of turbulence and heat and kind of interference from the outside, this kind of fragile state is destroyed. So the big challenge that guys working on this have right now is to make sure that they can keep these entangled states for a long time. Now, consciousness. So people, some very smart people have said that perhaps consciousness has some quantum entanglement states. For example, Roger Penrose, which is one of the smartest guys in this planet right now, has come up with this idea, and he teamed up with a fellow called Stuart Hameroff to see if indeed the brain has any kind of structures that could support this quantum entanglement so that consciousness is in some ways reflecting this action, spooky action at a distance that Einstein talked about. And the problem with that formulation, and this is still very much an ongoing debate, but the majority of people in the sciences would say that brains are incredibly hot and wet environments, okay, which means they are high temperature and they have a lot of fluids flowing around, and that is really bad for entanglement. So you can do some calculations and you can show that in that kind of environment, it's hard to keep it. That's not a bad story, but it doesn't look too good for entanglement in the brain.
Dr. Marcello Gleiser, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Island of Knowledge, The Limits of Science, and The Search for Meaning. And obviously, we're thinking very deeply here today. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll return from a break with Marcello Gleiser and your phone calls and emails in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Dr. Marcello Gleiser. He is a professor of natural philosophy and professor of physics and astronomy at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. He has written a book called The Island of Knowledge, The Limits of Science, and The Search for Meaning. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. We've gotten in pretty deep so far, talking about the origins of the universe, the speed of light, the speed of thought, and a bit more. It's a very comprehensive book, makes us think about the things we think about, and how we know what we know. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email address jx@jeffnet.org. We have an email from Deborah. She says, when I was teaching science to adolescents, I used to emphasize that the more you know, the more you find out you don't know. Thank you for that, Deborah. Let's go to a call from Dave in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Marcello Gleiser.
Morning, gentlemen. How you doing?
Good. You?
Good. Thank you.
Question, Doctor. Given the current rate of expansion, the Hubble constant, how far would a particle have to be today, as we speak, in light years, to where it is moving away from us at the speed of light?
Ah, that's a very good question. It turns out that it won't happen. You know, things will not really be moving away from us at the speed, faster than the speed of light, because in the equations that describe how the universe expands, you have a correction for that. So things do move fast, and in fact, in 1998, we found out that things move faster than we expected, in the fact that faraway objects are accelerating away from us. So it's even, the universe is expanding even faster than we thought it were, like even that recently, you know, 1998. But it turns out that that won't happen. So what does happen is that, because the reason is, well, the reason is essentially this, that the universe has a finite age. And so as we look out into the sky, we're looking back in time, so to speak. So when you see the sun, you're seeing the sun, as it were, 8 minutes ago. When you're looking at Andromeda, which is our neighbor galaxy, you're seeing it, as it were, 2 million years ago. And you keep going back that way, and you're always going to hit a certain barrier, which is how far light has traveled in this time, which happens to be 46 billion light years. Okay, so in 14 billion years, light has traveled 46 billion light years. Now, how is that? Well, it's just because the expansion of the universe takes the light with it, just like a wave takes a surfer with it and increases its speed and enhancing, not its speeds, but increases its, in the case of the surfer, it does increase its speed, but increases the distance that it can travel in a given time. The expansion of the universe sort of takes light farther out than just the 14 billion light years that you thought you would have traveled. But that is then defining what I call this bubble of information where we live in. So we can only gather information from up to that point. And what's beyond that is probably more universe, but we can't see it the same way that you can't see beyond the horizon line when you're standing by a beach. It doesn't mean the ocean ends there, but it means that's the limit of what you can see.
Just too far away for us to be able to get a glimpse of it.
Yes, and so that's a really good question about the speed of light. But it turns out that there is a kind of a self-correcting effect in the equations that shows that objects will not, at least for now, accelerate faster than the speed of light. No, because of this acceleration that I mentioned before, which is called dark, it's provoked by something we call, or caused, I guess, by something we call dark energy, which we still don't know what it is. In the far distance future, you're right, things will kind of rip apart, and all structures will be kind of destroyed. It's sort of a bad ending for things, so to speak. And at that point, the speed of light will just be a memory. I mean, we don't have any information of what will go on there.
So you do get into dark matter and dark energy in the book. I mean, so if it is dark, how do we know it's there?
Because it has mass, it pushes around stuff that does shine, like stars and galaxies. So it causes variations on the ways galaxies and stars behave. And so basically, it's like this: if what we reason is like, if all that we can see is the matter that shines, then the behaviors of galaxies should not be what we observe. And to explain that kind of behavior, basically, galaxies are rotating faster than they should be. Galaxies and things called clusters of galaxies, which are bunches of galaxies that move around each other because of gravity, are moving way too fast for the speeds to be caused just by the gravitational pull. So clearly there is invisible matter that is increasing the dynamics of all this stuff, you know, is making things move faster than it should, and that's what we call dark matter. So we can see it indirectly by what it does to stuff that we can see. Now, the dark energy is a whole different ballgame. So dark energy is really mysterious, and it contributes about 70% of what's the stuff that fuels the universe, which is a lot. It's like the majority of the stuff. And its effect is essentially to stretch space as faster than we thought it would. So it is this dark energy that is causing the accelerated expansion that I mentioned before. And we still have no clue what it is. It's a big mystery.
All right, while we're talking about science and how we know what we know, our guest is Marcello Gleiser. His book is The Island of Knowledge. Here's a call from Jim in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, little simple question. What is the current party line that all of religious science and physical science uses to justify, through its pursuit of science and exploration of everything, the extinctions that it's led to of all manner of plant and animal?
Science led to extinctions? In what sense?
Well, as man explored everything around him and tried to gain more knowledge, from starting about 3,000 years ago up through about that's when the mass extinctions of a lot of flora and fauna really started.
All right, so by blundering, I guess, through the universe as we know it. Thanks for that, Jim. Appreciate it. Marcello Gleiser, does science have much answer or apology for some of the destruction it has led to?
Yeah, I would say that that's not quite a fair assessment of what science is doing. I wouldn't blame the pollution and the destruction of flora and fauna on science itself. I would blame it on humans and the way we grow without thinking about what we're doing to the environment. And that's not necessarily a scientific problem. It's really a problem of morals, you know, how we humans behave in the planet that we inhabit. So I would imagine that if we could evolve a little more morally and understand the importance of life and the importance and how rare really our planet is around other planets, we would slowly, hopefully anyways, shift from this kind of destructive and parasitic behavior that is ours. But I would think it's kind of unfair to blame science for that. I mean, science is a tool that is created by people, and that tool, as any other tool, can be used to do good or do bad. And the choices that are made to do good or do bad are the choices that men and women make, mostly men, really. And that is what should be important for us to talk about, not so much science itself, because without it, would still be in the Middle Ages, which was probably not a very good thing to do.
Well, Jim gives us a chance to bring things from the edges of the universe back to Earth and talk about the second part of your book, which is about the elusive nature of reality, from alchemy to the quantum is the title of the section. So it's about what stuff is made of, and things like atoms and how long ago they were theorized. But there's particularly a section about alchemy, which is interesting because when Jim was talking about the way that people explored and extinction of species, things along those lines. People really in search of riches, and alchemy was really, was it all about turning things into gold?
I would say that is sort of the more popular view of alchemy, that it was all about, you know, turning lead and other metals into gold. But that is a very superficial way of thinking about what alchemy really stood for. You know, alchemy was more a combination of material and spiritual transformation. So through the motions of being in the laboratory, you know, in front of that crucible for a very long time, doing these very slow chemical experiments, the alchemist was not just trying to transform matter, you know, from a coarser kind of matter to the pure kind of matter, gold, you know, the metal that doesn't rust, right? So it was sort of royal for that reason. But it was also trying to purify himself and his spirit. So there was a combination of trying to transcend the limits, the material limits of existence through this alchemical ritual, you know, of burning and slow burning and mixing of different ingredients. That was almost like a ritual of self-cleansing as well. So as the alchemist succeeded or tried to succeed in this mission, he was also trying to succeed in becoming a better, purer person. So there was this goal, which is a spiritual goal of transcendence, that was attached to the alchemical practice. And of course, there was attached to all that was also another goal, which is that the so-called philosopher's stone, right, that would be the material that would accelerate this transformation of lead into gold, would also work as an elixir to give people not immortality, but certainly very long life. So the idea being that as you purify yourself through this alchemical process, you also become a much healthier person. You could still be shot dead, so to speak, or die in an accident, but you would not be ill anymore. So there was a dream there that you could extend life by this purification mechanism. So alchemy was much more than just the greedy aspect of changing lead into gold.
So it was a science that we apparently gave up somewhat reluctantly. And as you point out, there were lots of examples of ways in which we sort of mixed things we knew empirically, knew down to the facts, mixed with the occult. And I guess the question then is, we're considering what we know. Can we be sure that there's no longer any occult left in science today?
I think, yes, we can. There is no occult left in science today. I mean, in fact, science has divorced itself very wisely from anything like that. I mean, there is a very specific way in which we do science, which is following the scientific method, creating hypotheses that can be tested in the laboratory or through astronomical observations. These things have to be repeatable so other people can do them and get to similar results. And so this was exactly developed to distance science from false claims, you know. And so science is not about the supernatural. Science is about the natural. And that is a very fundamental distinction we have to make, that when we are looking at the world through the eyes of science, we are trying to make sense of things through rational thought and rational mechanisms that we can understand. Now, that doesn't mean that we understand everything, like I said in the beginning of the program. You know, we are surrounded by mystery, right? We are surrounded by what we don't know. But not knowing something doesn't mean that we have to invoke the occult or supernatural explanations to fill in the gaps. What it does mean is that we have to work harder and deal with our not knowing with humility so that we can keep asking questions and we can keep up advancing what we can know of the world and of ourselves.
So, Dr. Gleiser, is one of the issues of our time just that the things we still have to learn are harder than what our ancestors had to learn? I mean, they had to learn about things like, gee, we're living on the side of a globe, on the side of a sphere, instead of a big flat plane in the middle of nowhere. So, I mean, the things they had to learn, were they less difficult than the things we still have to learn?
You know, I don't think so, because you have to think of all this in context. And if you put this in context, every age has its own cutting-edge questions, right? And those cutting-edge questions are the hardest questions you can ask. So to people, you know, 3,000 years ago, to know if the world was a sphere or not, or if you ended at the horizon and you fell into nothingness, was the cutting-edge question. You know, it may sound silly to us nowadays, unless you're a flat earth kind of person, but the truth is that to them it was as hard as the meaning of quantum mechanics or what happened at the Big Bang is to us. So I would caution this sort of way of thinking that, you know, the harder questions are now ours and people before had it easy. I think that every age has its difficulties and every age has a cutting edge question. And so in about 50 years or 100 years, what are the cutting-edge questions and the real hard questions for us will be a piece of cake for our successors. So, and that it speaks right to the heart of what knowledge is, right? Knowledge as this ongoing pursuit that is always self-correcting and is always open-ended, and that's what makes it exciting.
It really does, and I really enjoy our talks. I wish we could have more than every 4 years. Marcello Gleiser is the author of The Island of Knowledge. Thanks again for joining us on The Exchange.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, take care.